I definitely got that kind of scoffing when I walked into the room on day one. People treated me like a kid. There were a few that commended me for it and said, good job, you're at this age and you're doing this, that's great. But many of the members of the company really, I could tell, didn't believe that I belonged there.
And they were like explicit about that.
Yeah, a little bit. It was the comments like, hey, buddy, come on, dude. You're not like, leave me alone. Let me prove myself first before you start treating me like I'm a little kid. But I kind of just used that as fuel. I thought to myself, I'm going to prove them wrong. And then I did. When I really got past that age thing was when I was at a trade show. It was my first trade show. I was terrified. I had no idea because I thought they're going to come up to me and think, who's this kid trying to tell me about this product? These people have literally been operating the product that I'm trying to tell them is worse than ours for longer than I've been alive. That was a scary thought. But for whatever reason, I just got up right before I went into the show and I thought, I'm going to think of myself as a 26-year-old.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
So I'm here again, finally, with Nick Runlett. Hi, Nick.
Hello, Brett. Awesome to be back. Wow, it's been a crazy year.
Remember our career launch stories monthly series?
Wow, I do remember that monthly series.
Yeah, so we have a great show with your friend and colleague, Logan, and I just wanted to have a chance to talk to you in front of everybody and bring people up to speed. So we started this at the very beginning, or maybe even the end of 2019. I was thinking it might have been the beginning of 2020. Then I asked in March, while we were both in, I think, a period of adjustment and change, right? I was traveling from one place to another. I think you were in a kind of transition as well. I said, why don't we hit pause on that and talk about what's going on right now? And it actually led to like five or so conversations. That was how we chose to spend what should have been our second episode of Career Launch Stories. So I wanted to follow up with you and hear what has changed in what is now, geez, it was 5 months ago today that I got in my car and left Pittsburgh to come back to New Hampshire, anticipating vague terms like quarantine and lockdown. I didn't know what those things were going to mean, so I just acted as if it was going to be restrictive and not, we're calling things this, but you can still technically do whatever you want. Yeah, that was 5 months ago today. What's changed for you?
Damn. I mean,
I know.
Well, I've had this general sense in my life that things seem to be happening faster and more things are happening in a increasingly condensed period of time. And so 2020, I think by far has been the fastest year of my life, just in terms of like personal growth, but also world events and things that are happening. So, I mean, a lot has happened. Professionally, Toggle has experienced a ton of growth. Personally, I ended up having like a move-in situation with my new girlfriend, which happened like entirely because the quarantine and flights got canceled like the second that she was due to visit me. So that was a totally new, awesome, crazy, interesting experience for me.
That is relatable as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder how many other folks, Brett, are in a situation like that where their relationships made a massive shift as a result of all this. It's interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I also think that, you know, even existing relationships probably experienced a lot of external pressure that people weren't ready for. You know, I like to think that I have the ability to take a stoic approach to these things, but shit, I certainly wasn't ready for everything that happened in the last 5 months, nor did I deal with everything like perfectly to my satisfaction. But can I just ask you a question before you go on? Because I do want you to expand on that. But when you talk about things happening faster, I was kind of reflecting on the conversation that we had back in March. I think at the time, I was almost thinking things were going to happen a lot faster than they did. You know, it took a while for, I think everything we said in that show happened, but it took longer than I thought. I thought it was all going to be like over the next 30 days. Like I went up to Northern New Hampshire in April, like into the mountains, and I thought I was just going to watch the world burn from there. And the whole time I was there, absolutely nothing happened. So I think I miscalculated a little bit as far as timetables, but I also get what you're saying in that there has been obviously this greater pressure or urgency to make things happen personally. Well, the news cycle has just been insane, and it's very, very hard to integrate and adapt to all of the changes in the last 5 months. I get what you're saying about the personal stuff too. It's been fast and furious for sure.
100%. And on the concept of the external timeline of COVID going slower than anticipated, I think that based on all the data that was coming out at the time, it looked like, oh, it's a virus and viruses exponentially grow. And so if we continue at the current pace that we are, then it's reasonable to expect that things will be really bad within the next 60 days of us recording that podcast. But then that's when all the lockdowns and stuff happened. And lockdowns, I think, necessarily slow things down. But then, man, it's strange how as I've looked into more and more of this, how my opinions of the severity of COVID have actually changed. And that could be its own whole rabbit trail, but it's still a real disease. It's still a real pandemic. But I do also believe that it's not going to kill the tens of millions of people globally I initially projected based on the best available data.
Yeah, I feel and at the beginning, I didn't know. It was hard for my mind to work exponentially. I knew that there was going to be a government response that I probably didn't love. And watching how the public around, like, you know, political and social issues had been getting along in years prior, I had a feeling that that was going to be a foreboding thing as well. I think we nailed both of those, but it's certainly not over yet. And I think one of the things that we've just tried to both focus on is like having a healthy diet of that information, just basically need to know without being obsessed. I think I went through an overconsumption period. I was talking to Isaac Morehouse about this on my show recently. We did a show called All News is Fake News. And I said, I was just casting nets everywhere and trying to collect as much information as I could. I was, you know, interacting with people in a Discord group who were doing the same. And it just became very quickly overwhelming. So to be able to, you know, moderate that better as far as an information diet, and I guess you've done the same thing, and focus that energy and attention in the sphere we control has been helpful.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because like attention is finite and so is energy. And I found that by giving a vastly disproportionate amount of my time and energy to like researching COVID statistics in New Zealand wasn't making me happier, believe it or not. It's still like necessary to keep updated to some extent. But to your point earlier, the news cycle has been so like just fucking bombastic over the last few months in particular. There's a lot more stuff to compete, even if you want to dedicate some of your time to keeping quote unquote up to date on current events. Current events are just swirling out of the gutter left and right. It's nuts.
Yeah. And every time you see I shouldn't say you because I don't want to make you sound paranoid. But every time I see something, I'll sound paranoid. I go, is this a psyop? What is this? A psyop? You know, like, is this real? Is this entirely a synthetic? I've been doing that for months now. So I get it. I was for a few months there. I was involved in a project with my friend Daryl where we were trying to bring in some alternative voices about this whole thing and look at some of the, you know, the dissenting theories about what's going on here outside the mainstream news messaging about this thing. And I found that to ultimately just be, a worthwhile exercise that didn't have a lot of personal stakes. Mm-hmm. The discouraging thing about it is that everybody who has less of a capacity to learn, you know, new scientific concepts and information than I do, which, you know, I don't know how many people that is, But I know that there's probably a lot of people who do have that capacity, but probably don't have the willingness or don't have the belief in themselves that they could process and understand a lot of what's going on. For most people, I think it's safe to say for a great majority of people, what to believe and then how to behave as a result of that belief basically just comes down to an act of faith. It just comes down to who do you trust? What narrative do you find most comforting or seducing about this whole thing, whether it's CNN or Alex Jones? Yeah, we've certainly seen the costs of that as far as confusion and division are concerned. But I would ask you, with that backdrop, to offer us something constructive from your own life that we've started to hint at in the conversation so far.
Yeah, that's powerful. Okay, so I think that for me, I'm moving to Austin, Texas in literally 2 days.
Yes.
And a big motivator for that is that, especially with everything going on in the world and how crazy the external stimuli can be, I need to set up my environment so that it supports me in my mission. And so I literally hunted all around Austin for like this apartment that has a steam room inside of it, because steam rooms just like slam dunk kill my anxiety. And it's right next to, you know, all these lovely amenities and all this stuff. So my quality of life, everything around me is going to be set up so that like I have the minimum possible chance of feeling overwhelmed, of feeling depressed, of feeling anxious. And I think it's really easy for me to forget how big of a role that environment plays in that. And so like not everyone can just up and move, but one thing that I started doing as well is like I can't work inside of my home anymore. It feels claustrophobic. I just spent literally months on lockdown inside of my home. I've got to go to a coffee shop.
Yeah.
If I'm going to work.
Yeah.
And like that, the environment piece of it for me is key.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not too far away from where I was the last time we recorded one of these, but I now live, you know, in an entirely different place than I technically lived then. And yeah, that variety, being outside, going new places, being surrounded by the right people who are, you know, also in that sort of supportive and pro-growth mindset is really helpful. I do feel like a little too isolated. Like I'm not doing enough face to face. Like I have a pretty deep network of people around here that I just really haven't been reaching out to, and I know I could do a better job with that. But looking back at, you know, the information I had and the avenues that I had available, I'm feeling happy with the choices that I've made in the last several months.
Right. Yeah. Dude, I feel so strongly that people are key. Like if we surround ourselves with really good people who are curious and empathetic, literally as I was talking to you, I had a friend that I hadn't talked to in a couple of months, just like ring myself. And then I text them, sorry, I'm on a call. He's like, cool, man, just wanted to check in on you. It's like, hell yeah. People are so ready and eager to have someone else reach out to them. We could be that force for other people. You know, yeah. And no one is going to be like, ah, damn, why is Brett calling me? Why is Nick calling me? People are excited. I was super excited to see Jackson just like reach out of the blue. So I feel like that's something that we can all control.
Yeah, I think it helps develop that kind of appreciation that you're talking about, where something, you get this stress test and you recognize things that you might have been taking for granted, especially like both of us have pretty big networks from the things we've been involved in. We know lots of people. And I know sometimes like requests to communicate or requests to respond can seem like overwhelming or inconvenient. And as I say that now, I'm like, oh, that's really ungrateful. You know, it's wonderful to have all of these people in my life. And, you know, time is precious.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of reminds me too of Praxis. It's like one thing, it's a remote program and people inside are always really curious and excited to talk to each other. And then no one ever reaches out. And so I think Logan might've been on the call where I did this exercise actually, where I literally just said, all right, the biggest thing in this whole community is the community. Like you need to be building relationships, especially now, especially with everything that's been going on. Raise your hand if you'd be excited if someone reached out to you. raise your hand if you'd be willing to talk to him. Everyone's hand raises. It's like,
yeah,
of course. Of course. Everyone is hungry for connection. No one's going to say no. We just have these kind of like vague, I don't know, negative associations with reaching out, quote unquote, cold to people. But I feel like paradoxically, I'm most excited when someone I haven't talked to in a while reaches out.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I want to set an accountability for the next time we do one of these. I want to be able to tell you and all of the people listening about three reconnections that I did with people who are within a 20-mile radius of right here that I've been meaning to, like, oh, you know, that guy's just down the street, or, you know, that family lives right in the other town. I'm going to reach out. I'm going to connect, and I'm going to embrace the community that I have access to. Thank you for the inspiration to do that.
Beautiful.
I have 1 month.
I will hold you accountable.
I have 1 month. All right. Excellent. So can I ask you one question just before we get started with Logan? Why Austin?
I always felt a calling to Texas. And I think that there's like a very intrinsically pro-freedom, pro-individual liberty ethos to the state. It's also great that they don't have a state income tax. And then Austin, I already have like a small network of people that I know out there. It's a beautiful city. It's young, it's vibrant, it's got great energy. And I've been there a couple of times in the past. I feel like I just needed to jumble things up in my life. I need to, just like I did with Atlanta, you know, pack up all my stuff and just go and live somewhere for a few years that's exciting, where I get to build a new network. There's a huge technology sector in Austin as well. And it just seems like a right fit, just energetically almost.
Do you have a more optimistic vision of the rest of, like, because I think it's a big thing to consider right now. It's great that you have a network, but, you know, thinking about going to a new place or some kind of dramatic life shakeup, I'd just like to ask you about your optimism. Obviously, a lot of this is within your control and what you make of the situation for yourself, right? So you're not fated to some kind of existence based on what happens in the world around us, obviously. But what is your optimism about the situation in this country and around the world compared to what it was the last time we talked like this? And one of the reasons why I also wanted to start those conversations with you was you had been on top of this, trying to alert people to what was going on for like a whole month, if more than a month, prior to our right. conversation about it. So compare and contrast feelings then versus feelings now about like what the future might hold.
Right. Yeah. So big picture, I think the thing that gives me the most optimism is it's not obvious to me now that tens of millions of people are going to die. Right. So like the objective numbers seem like, you know, a few hundred thousand in the United States over the next year, year and a half, and maybe 400,000 attributed to COVID, not necessarily being from COVID, could happen over the next couple of years,
sure.
Which is sad, but it's not like the 5 million that was really realistic to anticipate just a few months ago. So there's that. Fewer people, it seems like, are going to die. But more importantly, I think that this is causing a lot of really major cultural shifts that are extremely positive. The fact that everyone is now working remote and it's now abundantly obvious that the world can function with a largely remote workforce, that's huge. That's going to cause such a major shuffle in so many like fields, technology, real estate, you name it. And it seems like school is even coming into question.
Right.
Like the narrative of kids have to sit in like cemetery row seating at a building that's modeled off of like a mental ward from the 1900s. Like that's no longer necessary. It's becoming increasingly obvious that kids can be educated from home and learn everything that they need to become functioning adults. And then that is going to kill college. I think that the fact that people are paying $50,000 a month to just do Khan Academy, but
yeah.
like at an Ivy League school is ridiculous. And so there's only positive shifts that are going to come out of stuff like that. And that's what definitely gives me hope.
And, you know, I'm interacting with lots of people like over the last few months who are kind of having a moment. You know, I think about Carrie McDonald and all the work she's done on alternative education and unschooling. Harvard grad, by the way, you know, but who's been promoting self-directed education on this show. She does. She works with Fee. She works with Cato. Corey DeAngelis, who has been a big school choice, like Let the Funding Follow the Children advocate for a long time. Isaac with Crash, Praxis, like the lots of people that I'm really rooting for seem like they're having a big opportunity right now. And I think I am by proxy as well. And so are you, you know, so I get that. And I, you know, I've been more deeply connecting with my friend Richard Grove's autonomy course. I don't know if you've heard much about that, but it is basically like a companion, or it's related to what the kind of boot camp that Praxis does. They have done a really good job of like maintaining community beyond the actual 12 or 16 weeks that the course runs. So I've been really immersing myself in that. I found that to be really motivating and really inspirational. And it's been great to help people if they have questions about, you know, I want to do media production or market myself or have my own brand. So yeah, I share, at this point, I would say, I share your optimism. I was more than willing, though, to compartmentalize and participate in a very cynical conversation about it yesterday. Lots of people obviously believe that, you know, we're headed to some kind of civil war in this country. I think there's plenty of evidence that that is a real possibility. But it is just really important to take a breath, step back, and say, what can I do? Our mutual friend Joel Bine and I just had a great conversation about, you know, sphere of control versus, or circle of control versus circle of concern. And, you know, outside of our circle of control, there is this circle of concern. And a year like 2020 certainly makes that circle of concern feel like it's strangling our circle of control, you know, or crushing it from all sides. So to just be mindful of that is really important. I am sure as hell not perfect at doing this. I give my performance so far this year like a C, but I think by the end of the year, I'm going to look back at it and say, you know what, Brett, B+. So it's a work in progress.
All we can hope for is a passing grade for the test of 2020.
Right. So that was it. I just wanted to be able to bring people up to speed and let them know, you know, we were and are committed to making this an ongoing conversation, primarily in the early stages with people that you've connected with or I've connected with from the Praxis program. But I'm glad we're back. I'm glad to be doing this.
Me too. And this conversation is going to be a lot of fun. So hope everyone enjoys.
Bang! Great!
My baby's from San Francisco. He paints that bridge across the bay. My baby's from San Francisco. He paints that bridge across the bay. But when he thinks he's all through, he has to turn around and paint the other way. I'm gonna get on a cable car. I'm gonna ride down to the bay. I'm gonna get on one of those boats, the ones that cruise around the bay. And when I get to his bridge, I'll holler, baby, throw those brushes away. Let's go to Fisherman's Wharf, top of the mark, Telegraph Hill, Golden Gate Park, see the Young Museum, go to Old Chinatown.
Welcome to episode 2 of Career Launch Stories with my co-host, Nick Runlett. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Brett. Super excited for this one.
Yes, absolutely. I was saying before we started, we did episode 1. We had high hopes for a monthly series here, and then 2020 happened. I've been waiting to get back to this for a long time. We said that we would hear the stories of people who primarily attended Praxis, since that was the greatest overlap with both of our networks, about how they circumvented college and found rewarding careers, I think much earlier than a lot of people do. And of course, Nick, you have a similar kind of story as a Praxis alum.
Yes, and so does Logan, who I'm really excited is joining us here today.
Absolutely.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, Logan. Logan Westberg is our guest. He is a Praxis alum, and he is currently a sales development rep at VMware. I wanted to just let you guys talk for a minute. And Nick, I wanted to hear about why you thought Logan was a good second guest for this series.
Yeah, awesome. So Logan has actually been like joining me inside of my sales mastermind that I started out of the Praxis community a couple years ago. And it's really crazy to think that week over week, we've been like meeting with a bunch of other folks in the Praxis community and helping each other solve problems. So Logan has been doing that for a couple of years. He's always struck me as someone who is like just reliable, good dude, but also like really hungry and motivated to learn and grow and be successful. I thought that he's just kind of like the perfect candidate for a conversation like this because dude's doing pretty well and he's a lot younger than you would think just by talking to him. So,
all right. So Logan, don't keep us in suspense. How old are you?
I'm 20 years old.
Now, by the way, I said this in the first episode. These are not infomercials for Praxis. We love Praxis. At School Sucks It. But we're going to talk to people who went there. So I want to know how you found it. Like, what were you looking for while, you know, lots of young, success-minded people, 17, 18 years old, are doing the big college tour? Why are you thinking differently back then? And how did that lead you to an alternative or even like searching for alternatives to going to college?
Yeah. So like you said, I don't want to make this just a long commercial for Praxis, but obviously it worked out pretty favorably for me. Might be useful to take a step back. I always kind of had a philosophy that school was a necessary waste of time. Really since middle school. This is something I was very vocal about with my parents, with my friends. I always thought that, well, I'm going to go waste my time at this classroom that I don't want to be in, learn about stuff that I don't really care about, just so I can get a piece of paper that says I'm eligible to go to more school, and then get another piece of paper that says I'm eligible to start looking at the job market. You know, I hated that idea, but I didn't really know there were other options out there. With that said, the fact that I was very vocal about it eventually led to my dad stumbling across an interview Isaac Morehouse did with Tucker Carlson about Praxis. And then he introduced it to me. I was very skeptical of it at first, of course, because it sounds too good to be true. But hey, I mean, I set up an interview, worked out pretty well. And then from there, not to get too far ahead, it kind of just felt like everything went really quick. And I found myself all of a sudden in a startup doing things that I really never thought I would be able to until I was in my late 20s.
What made you skeptical about it? Like, what were you trying to measure what you saw against, I guess I would say, as far as like college options that made you go, yeah, this is too good to be true?
Yeah. So I might be kind of preaching to the choir here, but being in public school, I was taught from the very start, the goal is to get to college. That's why I was there. And if I didn't get to college, then I would not be able to get a good job. That's something that was taught to me by the staff, the teachers, everybody in that system. And, you know, not to rag on my parents, but including them. I mean, they didn't really know that there were other options out there. So I had just assumed that there were no other ways to get a good job other than going to college. So hearing about this program and then finding out that you actually get a paid internship out of it, and it's only a 6-month boot camp to start with, it didn't feel like that was right. I felt like I had to start with some sort of lengthy 4-year process in order to just begin looking at the job market.
Mm-hmm. Where then they tell you that, sorry, you don't have any experience.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's something I saw my sister, another family member of mine, go through college, come out, and then not really have a whole lot of options available to her. Her choices were go to more school or settle for something you don't want to do. And that was a little worrying to me. So that kind of also built into my motivation to at least follow through with it.
Gotcha.
Even though I was originally skeptical.
Absolutely. So go back to like 17, 18 years old, go back 2 years and tell us where you envisioned yourself the best you could at the time. At like 23 or 24 years old?
Well, I always had interest in, I guess, end goal running my own company in some way. I didn't know what that meant, but I knew from a very young age that I wanted to work for myself and I wanted to create a product that people could be interested in. Now I'm not there yet, but I feel like I'm on a pretty good trajectory. The first step I knew was to get into the business world, whatever that means. And so I was essentially looking for, from a very young age, the quickest way to break into the business world and understand how a company functions, kind of get an idea of the basic organizations that are involved with making a company run, and then immersing myself in that. That's what I wanted to pursue very early on.
Excellent. So we are going to bookmark that and come back to it. But Nick, I wanted to hear about how you and Logan first crossed paths.
Yeah. Well, Logan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that I just like started saying like, hey, I run a mastermind every Thursday.
Yeah, that was the first time. That was the first time we met one-on-one. But Nick actually inspired me to get into sales. He was one of the main contributors in making that decision. For those who don't know, Praxis, essentially, when I was in the program, it might be changed by now, gave you a couple options. You could choose operations, marketing, or sales as the career path you wanted to pursue. And once you picked that, you had to go full on pursuing that. So one of the things we did every week was like a guest call where we had someone come and present. And Nick happened to be one of the presenters in a week that I was attending. And he talked to us about the great value of sales and getting into it. And that was my first, I guess, time I saw Nick talk. And then when I found out he had a mastermind, someone invited me to it. And that's where we really started talking.
So what was your whole personal orientation towards sales in the beginning? It was not super positive, right?
Yeah, no, definitely not. I thought it was sleazy and it was nothing I ever envisioned myself doing.
I'd like to hear from both of you on this. Nick, how do you think you helped change Logan's mind?
Yeah, so I think that I just laid down fundamentally the truth as I see it about sales. And that is that sales is one of the only professions beyond like diving nose deep into entrepreneurship where your personal development, like the quality of your character and how you choose to spend your time, the discipline and other virtues that you cultivate, ties one-to-one correlation with your personal income. And that's not something that was ever taught to me or even remotely suggested to me as a possibility.
So the feedback loop is great.
Well, feedback loop, but also like you're really fundamentally in control of how much money you make. Like you can make a shitload of money in sales if you're just someone who's willing to like put in the extra grit to learn and to become more disciplined and to become like more sociable and pleasant to interact with and like more knowledgeable, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, it's one of the only fields where there's like that right. Perfect correlation.
And you were sold, Logan?
Yeah, I would agree. That's kind of what interested me. The idea that your output is equal to your input in sales and you really are responsible for everything that you accomplish was very interesting to me. And also one of the things he mentioned was that many of the enterprise CEOs started in sales. You know, many of the successful company owners began their careers in sales. And that was something that, well, they're doing it, I better start looking into this a little bit more.
Right. So at this point, you're what, 18, 19 years old?
I think then I was 17.
17. Okay. So again, I'd like to hear from both of you on this since you obviously work together on it. First, Logan, what did you see as like the, aside from like the feeling that sales was sleazy, what personal obstacles do you feel you had to overcome and how did you overcome them? And that how, I'd like to hear from Nick too.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that Nick drove home very strongly in that first interaction I had with him was that sales is hard. You don't know what you're doing and you really have to be humble. That was a little bit scary. Of course, that challenge was a little bit interesting to me as well, something that I wanted to engage myself with. That's ultimately the other thing outside of it being sleazy, the bad reputation it had. You know, him kind of showing me that different perspective, something I never heard before, that, oh, actually, if you're a good person, that will equate to you being a good salesman. that interested me. So I guess I was ready to accept the challenge at that point, although it was a little bit intimidating.
Gotcha. Nick, can you expand on that? If you're a good person, you're a good salesman, or you can be a good salesman?
Absolutely. Yeah. Biggest like light bulb eureka moment for me happened when I learned that sales fundamentally is all about helping people solve problems. And your personal income is literally a function, an equation of how much you help people. And the better person you are, the better you are at helping people and the more money you make. And that eureka moment happened like before, not from a YouTube video, not from, you know, a lecture or a talk, et cetera. It happened when I was running my own business and I was helping a sweet old lady sell her coin collection. And I knew definitively after working with her that I paid her probably a couple hundred bucks more than any other dealer in town would. And so I really helped her. We had a really great time chatting with each other. She got fair market value for her stuff. And then I knew that I could flip that coin collection and ultimately make a profit of like 500 bucks. And I was like, holy crap. I literally just helped this woman solve a problem in her life better than anyone else in the market. And because I did that, I made money. And that was like the eureka moment. And that's really, once that was internalized, everything else started falling into place. I'm like, I got to do sales.
Right. So Logan, do you feel like you had a moment or series of moments like that?
Yeah. I mean, it was only something that got proven out as time went on. It was something that I believed going in, and I wanted to believe it because of course I was doing it. How could I be the bad sleazy salesperson? But really after my first year with the company I was at when it was still a startup, I realized like, oh, looking back, wow, that's a big difference in my personality and who I am. I never thought I would be in this position. You know, just even taking away the job, where it put me and the development that it forced me to make in my personality were pretty incredible. That was really after my first year with the startup that I got paired up with through Praxis. That's when I really realized that was a true idea.
Okay, I'm just curious, and it's okay if you can't go into detail about this. Is the company that you were paired up with at Praxis the company you continued to work for after, or how did the evolution happen?
Yeah, so usually that's how that works. It's typically, I guess, the formula when I was with the Praxis program was you do 6 months of an online boot camp. After that, you do 6 months of a paid internship, and then the company can from there decide whether or not they want to keep you. Thankfully, because I worked hard and I had to move all the way up to California from Arizona where I didn't know anyone, it was all I really had out there. So I made sure that I put as much in as I could. And after 3 months of being with the company, my manager asked me if I would just come on full time as an SDR as I started in a kind of lower position.
Excellent. So can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you've had along the way? The company was ultimately acquired, right, by a larger company, and that produced some challenges for sales personnel.
Yeah. I mean, to go back to the first challenge, having to commit to moving to California when all I knew was Tucson, Arizona. I've been here my whole life. I barely ever traveled. Having to pick up everything that I knew and everything that I had and just move out by myself was terrifying. And I remember the first day that I was in San Francisco at the company's HQ at the time.
Oh gosh.
I felt so out of my element. Like I had no idea where I was. And I was just thinking to myself, like, what did I do? How did I end up here? Like, this is going to go so terribly. So the first challenge was, I guess.
Wait a minute. Wait, I got to stop you. How did you live in San Francisco? How was this arranged?
So I actually had to live an hour away from San Francisco.
Okay.
Because, yeah, I mean, there was no way that I could afford to be there.
No, because I've been there and I've seen people there and I believe some of them live there. But I've also looked at like Zillow while I was there, and I've also seen some very unlivable parts of that city. So I'm like, you know, this is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. But how the hell does anyone live here?
Yeah. And the answer is not many people do live there. I mean, people work there, but there are very few people I knew of in the company who really lived there. I mean, you had to be on the CEO level. You had to be making millions to do it.
So you're there. right? You're out of your element. And I still feel like we have to get to some of the, like, the personal obstacles you had to overcome with the work. But now we're here and we're in San Francisco. And how does that adjustment happen for you?
It was really like going to a different dimension, a completely different culture. You know, it might not surprise you that Tucson, Arizona, the culture here is a little different than in San Francisco, California. But ultimately, it was like a dream that I was living in. And at a certain point, you know, I guess maybe an hour or so after I got there, I just said, well, I'm here. I made it. Maybe I do belong here. I might as well just give it a go, because what's the worst that could go wrong? You know, worst possible case scenario, this fails after 6 months and I go home. Once I let go of that, I just did the best I possibly could. It was very awkward at first having to present in front of people. I mean, they really threw you into the fire at this startup. You had to basically on the second day present the product to management. That was terrifying. But after I did that, I realized, oh, I'm okay. I'm still alive. This really isn't that bad. And maybe I do belong here.
What about things like cold calling? And obviously, like, I don't know what percent of propositions wind up being closed in this particular industry. So you have rejection, you have failure, you have uncomfortable social interactions, like all of these things are, I'm thinking, a part of being in this totally alien world. Talk about that a little bit. And then if the mastermind is a part of it, then I want to hear from Nick on the resolution to these challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, through interactions that I'd had with people through Praxis and also in the company before, I knew that cold calling would suck at first. And I knew that there was really no other way to get used to it other than just to hit the phones really hard. So one of the first days back that I got on the phones, we had this tool that essentially allowed you to dial multiple numbers at once. It was brand new in the office. Nobody was really using it yet. So I thought, okay, why don't I use this opportunity? I'll call some kind of garbage leads that nobody else wants to, and then see what I can do. So I loaded up 1,000 contacts and then kicked up the dial number to 10 and then went through 1,000 dials in one day. And that was really everything I needed to feel confident on the phone. I got tons of rejections. I had a very low conversion rate with the customers I was talking to. But ultimately, after that, I felt like I could do anything. It was really a super useful process to put yourself through that. It sucks when you're in the moment, but afterwards you realize, oh, these people can't hurt me through the phone.
right.
I'm going to be okay.
Man, I just think that that's a super powerful tool and I want to do that.
It's a lot of fun.
Like going through 1,000 calls in one day. That normally takes like a month.
Yeah. Can you explain that, Logan, how that works?
Yeah. So essentially in a company, going back to leads, you know, those are just some sort of interaction with the company or some sort of interest that they've had. They get loaded up into a database. And then this tool that we had could pull based on a set of criteria, a report of those lists of contacts. And then you loaded them into this tool. You saw all the numbers pop up. And then when you hit start, it just starts dialing the amount of numbers that you set going down the list. So essentially you could set it anywhere from like 2 numbers at once to 10. And if you connect with someone, it basically blocks all the other callers from being connected, if that makes sense.
Gotcha. Yeah, that does make sense. I only ever did this once, and it was very, very brief. And I think I pulled off 100 in a day once. But that's a lot of people not answering. That's a lot of people not answering their phone. So moving on to another challenge, which is the acquisition by this larger company and like the compensation structure being changed. And you're comfortable talking about some of the stuff that goes on in this mastermind? Usually that's a... Okay.
Absolutely.
So
I'm an open book.
Yeah. So I'll actually throw it to Nick on that one. What challenges around that time appear that the mastermind is helpful with?
Gotcha. Yeah. So maybe defining terms can be helpful to start. When I think of a sales mastermind or a mastermind in general, it's really just a whole bunch of experienced professionals and inexperienced, like hungry people who are looking to like emerge into a profession. And we all get together every single week and we just spend an hour helping each other solve problems. And it really is as simple as that. And when you come together like we do every single week, and you do that for, you know, at first, you know, a couple months, and then now a couple years, there's this really tightly knit container of just really awesome people who are smart, who have like made successes. We've helped each other make like major career shifts now at this point. And it's all just a dedicated hour of helping each other solve problems. So if you're like a new SDR or someone who's just trying to emerge into sales or figure out if it's right, you can come and you can come prepared with like specific questions like, man, I just started my job. I've got this crappy script that my boss gave me and it's just not working. And I know I can do better. How would you guys help me tweak this? And then, you know, the person who comes from a SaaS background in sales would say, man, you got to do this and this. And then the person who's insurance says like, yeah, I agree with that. But then I would tweak it. And like, you know, you've got to make sure that you get to the punch within the first 15 seconds. Just so many different perspectives all coming together. It's like having a sales coach with 200 IQ and 20 years of experience coach you. Because like that's the sum total of the intelligence right. of nine people.
Especially around this time where these challenges emerge with the acquisition of VMware, what are you guys trying to solve as far as keeping you, Logan, motivated and wanting to persevere through this?
Yeah, so the acquisition was something that nobody in my office expected. And it was also something that nobody in my office had ever gone through, even my manager, even a couple people in the company with a lot more experience. This is very new.
Yeah, I would just imagine it's like one of the most frustrating, unsettling, maybe in some ways scary, because obviously there's a lot of like personal security concerns in a shakeup like that.
It was totally unexpected. I mean, I remember the surprise all hands goes on our calendar. Nobody even has an acquisition on their radar. And then we hear from the CEO, we have been acquired by VMware. And after that, everything just went silent. I mean, nobody knew what was going to happen. And the days following were even more unsettling because we had the EMEA, the European team, just get fully cut. We were like, oh, what's going to happen to us in the United States? And then, you know, we kind of went through the motions. We weren't sure whether or not if we were just training the internal teams, because for those who don't know, VMware has hundreds of sellers. And we were interacting with them right after that acquisition, trying to train them up on the product. That was what our agenda was. Our objectives were told to us from the management. And we didn't know if we were just training these core reps to sell our product so we could be replaced. So it was very unsettling, really confusing. And something that the mastermind really helped with was figuring out how I talk to management about things. You know, it's something I've always been kind of good at, was talking to management, but there are a lot of uncertainties and I wasn't really sure how to approach them. So I think ultimately that was one of the number one things that the mastermind helped with early on, was talking to management about the what's to come.
I would think in a lot of organizations, even like forward-looking organizations, being a really young person trying to assert yourself in that situation would be rather difficult, not just in like the act of doing it, but mm-hmm. in the response you're going to get, like, thanks for your input, kid, you know? So can you talk about maybe some of the wisdom gained from that experience, whether it came from the mastermind or it came from actual practice?
Yeah. So the number one thing I would tell someone around my age who goes through an acquisition like that, someone who's in a similar scenario, is to always keep things in perspective and think about what the worst case scenario is, visualize that, and then make sure that you're okay with that. So for me, worst case scenario, everyone gets fired and I go home. Okay, big deal. You know, once I pictured that in my head, I was able to calm down a lot more. And then really just look at it from, I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to try and provide value to this company because that's what they've hired me to do. And if it doesn't work out, I have to believe in myself and understand that I have enough value to pick up another job whenever I want. And really just believing in myself was the best thing that I did during that time.
So I heard some stoicism in there.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, to go back to before this, and you understood or you believed that school was a necessary waste of time. I think even to like tune into that, like a lot of people have negative feelings towards school, but they're not really looking or questioning the actual function of school. Mm-hmm. And I think fewer people are doing that when it comes to higher education, or at least people who are on a professional track. They're not asking those questions, not enough of them yet. Mm-hmm. Even still, even in 2020, as far as I'm concerned, and obviously there's some bias in this, there's not enough people questioning college, mm-hmm. but you are. So you're building a worldview as a teenager, and since you just mentioned something that sounded kind of like Seneca to me, I wanted to ask what your other background influences, readings, like what was shaping your worldview as a slightly younger man?
You know, I'll be honest, when I was a little bit younger, I didn't read a whole lot. I wish I did, but I didn't. Mostly my influence was coming from, and I do not want to badmouth my father at all, but it came from seeing him have a lot of ideas and then never following through with them. I mean, that's honestly what it was he had all these great ideas. He thought of himself like an entrepreneur. And then I saw throughout all my childhood, him start and then stop, never follow through with any of them. And that was very disappointing to me because I felt like he had all this potential and he just never followed through with it. So I knew that, you know, it was great to get that training early on to think big. But I also learned quickly that it was more important to execute when you thought big. You know, I always thought big. I always wanted to execute and I wanted the quickest path to getting what I wanted, or at least realizing that. And I really didn't feel like analyzing it. School was the best way to do that. So I guess it goes back to always seeing big ideas in the household, always seeing them being developed and then never really coming to fruition.
Yeah. For me, I became more disillusioned with school my senior year when a whole lot of like content that I was consuming that really just broke down mainstream narratives that I was being fed as being completely false, that sparked this deep yearning and curiosity to understand how the world really works. And it also made me like internally question, what if this entire path that I'm being force-fed is complete bullshit? Because now I have all of the evidence that I need to see that school has nothing to do with giving me an education. Why would college not just be a further extension of that fake system that's meant to make me complacent and lazy and like a worker drone for someone else? Why can't I write my own ticket in life? And that's something that my dad had instilled in me as a concept. You know, he did a lot of things wrong, but that was one of the best things that he did for me. And so I just kind of completely tuned out of the idea. Even though I still ended up doing a couple years of college, because I think at the time I didn't have the confidence in myself to say like, man, I really fundamentally don't need this system. I know it's all bullshit. I viewed it as like, well, I don't know what I want to do with my life ultimately. I know I like solving problems, so I guess I'll be an engineer like my dad or something. And I'm really glad that ultimately I found sales, I found entrepreneurship. And it gave me all the ammunition I needed to drop out.
So this is interesting. We all have lessons from our dads, from watching them do things wrong, or I guess in Logan's case, not watching them do enough. I mean,
Yeah. My
dad was a guy who, you know, didn't go to college, barely finished high school, and just kind of cut this path through the chemical industry and was running a really, really successful company by the time he was in his early 30s and sold the company and could have retired at the age of 38 and decided that if he's 38 and he's in that situation, he must be some kind of really genius entrepreneur. So he said, well, I'm gonna buy another company and just do the same thing. And it was basically, you know, the Hindenburg. In a very, very short period of time, like just a couple of years, and we lost, you know, almost everything at that point. So like there was money set aside for me and my two brothers to go to college. That all evaporated. And I think the lesson from watching that you know, so I grew up in a wealthy family and got accustomed to a certain way of life. And by the time I was like 14, you know, going to high school where, you know, you've got to get all the right clothes and shoes and stuff. And all of that was just gone. It was an interesting, it forced a lesson in me. And I don't think, maybe I couldn't articulate it at the time, but it was something like, you have to find an intersection. There's lots of intersections that you have to find, but one of them is what you're good at, what people want, and what you're passionate about. And all my dad had in that second business venture was something that people wanted, or something that people needed. The company made printed circuit boards, which are those green things inside any piece of electronics. But he wasn't passionate about it, and he wasn't good at it. And, you know, that was the result. So that kind of segues into choosing an industry. If you want to launch your career in sales, and I totally understand why both of you guys have gone this route because of the opportunity and that kind of feedback loop that we've discussed as far as like you get out what you put in. But what if somebody who's skeptical about, you know, that vocation, they think it's sleazy or whatever, or they have some of these other obstacles that Logan talked about, like, I don't want to make cold calls. I don't want to deal with rejection. What advice would each of you give about choosing an industry to pursue that career?
I'll speak from my own experience. I personally had absolutely no interest or experience or passion for the industry that I entered to start my sales career. And I'm really freaking thankful for that. Because I was selling something that's like fairly straightforward and simple as a concept, but to very technical, smart, you know, just high intelligence people. I was selling to guys in IT. And that forced me to get really sharp in like learning an entirely new universe of problems and concerns and like motivations, et cetera, trying to really understand the psychology of the prospect. And that was really helpful for me. So I feel like with sales, you can try to find opportunities that you feel really aligned with something that you're passionate about. And that can be a great arrow in your quiver when pitching a company, saying like, look, I actually give a crap about what it is that you do and what you sell. And I want to be a part of your mission because I love what you do. That's powerful. But I would also not make it the holy grail standard, like, you know, especially in today's job market and economy, like you can have a really good deal of success and learning experience selling something that you previously were unfamiliar with. It's immersing yourself into something that's totally foreign. Like no matter what, that's a valuable experience.
Okay. So you don't have to be like personally fully immersed in it as far as like passion is concerned. It's about something else. It's part of a larger process.
Yeah. I would say that like passion is more important for entrepreneurship.
Right.
It's much less important for sales.
Okay. Yeah. Logan, you feel the same?
Yeah, I mostly do. I mean, I think people should think about what it is that they want to do starting out at an early age. To me, I still haven't fully realized what that is, but at least get an idea of the area you want to be in the end, like what your end goal is, and then pick a type of role, type of position that will get you closer to that. So obviously I sell software defined load balancers. I didn't know what a load balancer was. Most people don't. It's not something that I think is very sexy or I'm passionate about, but I knew it would be a challenge because it's complex and I'm forcing myself to learn very quickly about something that previously would have not even come across my radar. So I agree that, yeah, putting yourself in an uncomfortable position and forcing yourself to be fully immersed into it, that is something that is very important to do early in your career as you're launching it.
Gotcha. Okay, so there's this term, grinding. Do you feel like that is what your career is about? Or is that a verb that describes the current stage of your work? Is that you're trying to grind through something to produce new opportunities? Or because there's a whole culture around that, maybe you find that description off-putting?
You know, I think the term grinding is in itself temporary, and I don't really like that. I think people should build their starting careers out of their own motivation, their own disciplines, And grinding to me feels like it's, I'm gonna power through this short term so that when I get to the end of the tunnel, everything will be better. In a position like sales, or really in most starting positions in a company, you don't ever reach the end. Everything continues to be difficult. And if you just focus on really going hard in one specific area for a short amount of time, I think you're going to burn out. And ultimately, I think that's why, especially in sales, the turnover for the people who come in and then leave right away is very high. I think it's like something like 60% of SDRs will leave within the first 4 months of their role because they get obsessed with grinding. And then all of a sudden, I can't do this anymore. This is no way to live. So I think really what's most important starting out your career is to build principles and disciplines that can be carried over forever. And grinding really isn't going to help with that, in my opinion.
Okay, because obviously, you know, I'm 20 years older than you are, and my career was in an entirely different industry, education, and grinding was not a term that people applied to work. But I think a lot of us start that way, no matter what our job is, no matter what industry that we work in. If we're career-minded at 20, 21 years old, we're young, we're energetic, we don't have a lot of other commitments, right? We probably don't have a house we have to worry about. We don't have children in most cases. So you have all of this time and attention to devote to work. And I remember feeling that way about the work. It was just really, you know, unfortunately in an industry with no opportunity. Now, I didn't see that at the time because I didn't have principles clarified. If I had my principles clarified, my goodness, I would have been doing something else even 20 years ago. There were things about working in education that I liked. It was meeting needs that I had. And I think there was this idea that far off, like the longer, if you're a teacher, the longer you do it, the easier your job gets. So it would make sense that you have to front load it with lots of like long hours, hard work, weekends. And I remember being at the job, the school I worked at, it was a really tough school, and people saying, everybody starts here. This is what it's like in the beginning. Yeah, it sucks. But then, you know, it wasn't like be happy now. It was like be unhappy now, be miserable now. So as time goes on, things will just get, you know, you'll have that. What you hear is like the dream job of a teacher where you hardly have to do anything. And that never really happened for me. So I was just curious because I just have an entirely different perspective based on how my career has gone.
Yeah. I mean, so by no means am I saying that I didn't work a little bit harder in the early period of my career than I do now in terms of just the hours and the time that I put in. But with that said, I made sure to keep the big picture in mind. I think that's most important because grinding out, especially in a sales role, is only going to get you so far. You can get somewhat comfortable because all the principles, all the things that you learn, you take with you. But in sales, if you're not constantly improving, you're falling behind, in my opinion. I think that really can be applied to any type of career path. People should think about what is my end goal? What is the best thing that I could do with my life? And how do I get there? For me, it's just not that satisfying to think about, okay, I'm going to be good at sales and then I'll finish and then I'll retire when I'm 50. You know, that sucks. Even if you make good money doing it, what's the point? You know, I think people should think about how they can do something meaningful with their lives, and just focusing on making your job easy is not going to get you there. So in my opinion, you should always be improving no matter what you're doing, and thinking about it as it's going to suck right now, but in a couple months, it'll be easy. I think that's kind of defeatist and a little bit lazy, honestly.
I totally agree. And that's probably why there's such high turnover in sales. And, you know, in the industry I was in too, like it was kind of like education / social services. So a lot of young people would come out of college and they'd last 3 years and then they'd be totally burnt out and they'd have to change careers completely. Mm-hmm. So I totally understand what you're saying. So can you talk about how maybe through these experiences over the last year, you've gotten closer to finding what that meaning is?
Yeah. So ultimately, I want to start a company. And I understand in order to do that, you need money. So right now, I'm in a period of my career where I'm taking the things I'm learning in my sales career and applying them to real estate. So that's the area I want to learn the most about. And one of the cool things about school is, I mean, technically at my age, I could still be sitting in a classroom right now, learning about things I don't care about. I can spend my free time, instead of learning about, you know, math or social studies, the curricular, I can spend my time learning about real estate and how to invest in that so that when I'm in my mid-30s, I have enough money to have flexibility with the ideas that I have and I can try things out. So that's what I'm doing right now, is trying to build up my wealth so that ultimately I have freedom to try out new things in the business world, try out new products and ideas, which is where I want to be at the end of my career.
Excellent.
So Logan, I feel like a super big part of your story that really aligns with mine, and this is a reason why I respect you so much as well, you've prioritized growing in your self-awareness and in your personal development. And you've always had a mindset of like wanting to, you know, increase your skills and work hard. But the other piece of it that I feel like has contributed a lot for both of us is focusing on self-awareness. And I'm just curious, like, what are your overall thoughts on like how that's impacted you?
Yes. So maybe one of the reasons I do consider myself to be pretty self-aware, and maybe one of the contributors to that would be that my age, honestly, you know, putting myself in an environment with, I think the second youngest person was like in their low 30s. It was a little awkward being the kid in the environment. And it's like, who's this punk, basically? That's kind of how I felt. But what I learned over time was that if I prove my value first and then people learn my age, they never mention it. So being self-aware in that way, I kind of realized that there really aren't many limitations that I can't overcome as a person, whether that's my age or something else. So leading from that, looking at things like the acquisition, for example, nobody had experienced that before. I had no idea. I mean, I barely knew what an acquisition meant. So going through that process, I had to keep reminding myself like, oh, I've done this before. I've come into a completely new environment and then dominated before. So I could probably do it again. So that comes back to stoicism and believing in yourself, and just ultimately thinking that you can accomplish anything if you put in the right effort, and not really limiting yourself based on what you're capable of.
I super appreciate the chip on the shoulder mentality that you like realized that you had and could then cultivate. Like you used the age differential at your work as like a source of fuel and motivation. Like, tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I definitely got that kind of scoffing when I walked into the room on day one. People treated me like a kid. There were a few that, you know, commended me for it and said, good job, you're at this age and you're doing this, that's great. But many of the members of the company really, I could tell, didn't believe that I belonged there.
And they were like explicit about that.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I mean, it was the comments like, hey, buddy. Like, come on, dude, you're not like, leave me alone. Let me prove myself first before you start treating me like I'm a little kid. But I kind of just use that as fuel. I thought to myself, I'm going to prove them wrong. And then I did. And that was one of the best experiences I ever had, was really showing myself that, oh, wait, if I just carry myself like I'm one of them, all of a sudden they treat me like I am. If I give into that, and let them put me down because maybe I feel like I don't belong here, or they don't feel like I belong there, then they win. So the peak moment for me when I really got past that age thing was when I was at a trade show. It was my first trade show. I was terrified. I had no idea, because I thought they're going to come up to me and think, who's this kid trying to tell me about this product? I've been using this solution that they're trying to sell against for longer than this person's been alive. That's how I thought about it in my head. Like, oh shit. Yeah, these people have literally been operating the product that I'm trying to tell them is worse than ours for longer than I've been alive. That was a scary thought. But for whatever reason, I just got up right before I went into the show and I thought, I'm going to think of myself as a 26-year-old. And once I did that, everything worked out. Like, I at no point felt awkward. I just felt like I was one of everyone else and there was nothing stopping me from operating like everyone else there as well.
I love it. So the last question that I have for you And I think this is going to summarize and review some things we've already talked about. I hope that we have, you know, there's lots of parents in this audience, and they have teenagers. Even if they have what I think is a healthier orientation, these youngsters, towards school and college and the non-essential nature that they have in today's world, what would be the most useful advice you think you could give to somebody who is at that point where they're about to launch a career?
Yeah, I just tell them, if you're at that age, you have plenty of time left and you should not think small. You should think as big as you possibly can and then get as far as you can along that process. Because if you're thinking big and you're making progress in that direction, even if you don't make it to the end goal by a certain point, you're still probably better off than you would have been if you just settled for a certain career path and said, well, I'll probably do this because that's what my dad did. Or I'll probably do this because it's easy. You know, think about what the best possible life you could have is, and then do whatever you can to pursue it.
And one more follow-up question. That as you gain wisdom, you have to revise that, right? You've probably done a revision or two already.
Mm-hmm.
So anything you'd add about the consciousness that's needed to maybe not be too laser focused down a tunnel, right? To accept input and information that allows you to be flexible, to be fluid.
Yeah. I think what helped me was having a few examples, a few role models in my life that I could look up to and then study how they got to the point where they were. So in other words, thinking about the richest person or the most heroic person that I know of, and then looking at where did they start, saying, oh, well, they started kind of like everyone else did. You know, there are plenty of stories out there of people who started off a lot worse off than I did and were a lot more successful in the end. So just looking at successful people's lives and then figuring out the steps they took was a really good way for me to get started. And then ultimately putting those steps for myself on paper. So think about where do I want to be in the end? And then what's the first step I can take to start moving in that direction? Really making it real in that way helped me a lot.
I love it. And looking into people like that, I think really helps you break the schooled mindset to whatever degree you might have had it. Maybe some people have it more than you, where, you know, the setup as far as school is concerned is like when you're six, it's like, okay, everybody get in this tube and walk through the tube, and eventually there's another side of where the tube ends, right? And there's the world that you've been waiting for. Whatever success means to any person, it means different things to everybody. It never looks like that. It never feels like that. So I think that's extremely valuable.
Wait, and one more thing I'd like to add is that at my high school graduation, because, you know, I'll say high school, I didn't really need to graduate it. It didn't really help me in the end, but I did to make my parents happy. And at the end, I looked at the amount of people that graduate high school. And I thought to myself, wow, that's pretty average. And the amount of people who graduate college, oh, that's also pretty average. And I told myself, I don't want to be average. So what are the exceptional people doing? What are the people that I look up to doing in order to become exceptional? And that's ultimately what got me to where I am today and put me in the right mindset to continue moving forward.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story. And Nick, thanks for inviting him. This was a really great conversation.
100% agree. This was awesome.